VOA News, I'm Lori London. Both sides in the debate over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in the United States are holding their ground after release of a report on an FBI investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Republicans like Utah's Orrin Hatch say the report shows no hint of misconduct by Brett Kavanaugh.
It's time to end this charade.
The FBI investigation looked into allegations of sexual misconduct. Virginia Democrat Tim Kaine says it didn't go far enough.
I'm not allowed to discuss it. The public can't see it. It's a complete sham.
Protesters were arrested at a Senate office building, including comedian Amy Schumer.
They cannot keep us down. We will win. A vote for Kavanaugh is a vote saying women don't matter.
Orrin Hatch says the Senate can't turn away Brett Kavanaugh.
He is going to be a great justice, perhaps one of the greatest we've ever had.
Ed Donahue, Washington.
The West has released new evidence and indictments accusing Russian military spies of hacking so widespread that it seemed to target anyone anywhere who investigates Moscow's involvement in an array of criminal activities, including doping, poisoning, and the downing of a plane. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says Russia will be held accountable for the cyber attacks.
The GRU cyber attack, which has been revealed on the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, is the latest in a worldwide pattern of reckless and irresponsible behavior from Moscow.
Russia defiantly denied the charges. Special Counsel Robert Mueller is trimming more attorneys from his team, another sign that prosecutors have begun winding down parts of their investigation. Two prosecutors detailed to the Russia investigation are returning to their duties in other parts of the Justice Department. Two other attorneys left over the summer. This is VOA. Indonesia's disaster agency says the death toll from the earthquake and tsunami that struck central Sulawesi Island a week ago has surged past 1,500. Hungry survivors say they're scavenging for food in farms as President Joko Widodo made a second visit to the area. Michelle Hennessy reports.
Desperate residents pleaded with President Joko Widodo during his visit to the disaster zone on Wednesday. Help, they're shouting. Many people are in need. At the site of a collapsed seven-story hotel, this is what he told reporters.
The most important thing is I've sent a message to the governor and regent for economic activity to restart so that they can start heading back to a normal day-to-day life while evacuations continue to be carried out.
For mourning relatives, that might not be the priority. This is what's left of a church where 80 children were studying the Bible when the quake struck. The disaster turned the ground to liquid.
That's Michelle Hennessy reporting. Sudan will begin on Sunday setting its daily currency exchange rate using a newly formed body of bankers and exchange bureaus, part of a package of measures designed to tackle an economic crisis. Sudan is also canceling import restrictions. The controls had been imposed last year in an effort to cut the deficit and protect the Sudanese pound. Sudan's economy has been struggling since the South seceded in 2011. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, sharpening U.S. criticism of Chinese policies around the globe, will give China a blunt warning that the U.S. will not back down from what Washington sees as Chinese intimidation in the South China Sea. Ryan Brooks reports.
It's likely to escalate already soaring tension between the two nations on issues from trade to defense ties. During an address in Washington, he'll call recent Chinese action in the South China Sea reckless harassment and will vow to not stand down in the disputed waters that China claims as its own. A U.S. Navy destroyer sailed near islands claimed by China on Sunday, and Beijing retaliated by sending its own ship to sail dangerously close to the USS Decatur, within 45 yards. It had been part of what the U.S. calls a counteroperation to Beijing's efforts to limit freedom of navigation in the area. China later voiced anger over the encounter and called the operation a threat to its sovereignty.
Marion Sooj Knight was sentenced Thursday to 28 years in prison for mowing down and killing a businessman in a case that completed the former rap music mogul's downfall from his heyday as one of the biggest and most feared names in the music industry. I'm Lori London, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroonians go to the polls this Sunday in presidential elections.
I understand that the problem is not a military problem, it's a political problem and has to be solved politically. As such, I understand that there should be no political prisoners in Cameroon as well.
Joshua Osi is the candidate of the main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. Raila Odinga adds his voice to the growing calls for a constitutional referendum in Kenya. 50 million people in Africa now have access to electricity thanks to the Power Africa Initiative. Nkosatu welcomed President Ramaphosa's announcement to reduce South Africa's high unemployment rate.
What President Ramaphosa announced was the work of the all social partners, meaning labor, government, community and businesses, has been working for the last 3 months to conclude what was pronounced.
Beki Unshalinshala is the General Secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions. The UN says populist politics around the globe are eroding protection for refugees. And we'll tell you about a proposal that allows cocoa farmers in Ghana to register forest trees on their farms. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroonians go to the polls this Sunday in presidential elections where 85-year-old Paul Biya, in power for 36 years, is running again for another term. Top among the issues facing the country are youth unemployment, changing the presidential term limit, and the turmoil in the country's English-speaking regions where secessionists have declared an independent Abyssinian. Joshua Osi of the main opposition Social Democratic Front Party is one of two presidential candidates from the volatile English-speaking regions. He says Cameroon's youth unemployment is a national security threat that must be addressed or else the country will likely implode.
Well, I think the youth unemployment, it is such that it is a national security threat because movements are able to exist because, especially if you look at Boko Haram, for instance, in the far north and other major insecurity in the east and north and Adamawa regions exist because of feed on the back of the joblessness of the youth. And so it is important to understand that if we cannot address that issue appropriately and as soon as possible, the country will likely implode.
You are from English-speaking region of Cameroon. The last time I spoke with you, I mentioned the insurrection going on there, you know, the so-called Ambazonian secessionist movement. The issue is whether the English-speaking should remain part of the Cameroon Federation. Your take is that are you staying within the Federation?
I'm proposing a federal arrangement, and I'm proposing to resolve as many, if not all, of the issues at stake and that have been put on the table to try to solve the political issue at stake. I understand that the problem is not a military problem, it's a political problem and has to be solved politically. Not only should the issue be solved politically, but all the political prisoners should be released immediately. Now, there is a certain orientation for secession. There is another one for a unitary state, centralized states, and there is a third opinion that is looking at the federation. So all these opinions must be respected, and we need to talk to each other so that we agree on an inclusive way forward.
President Paul Biya, 85 years old, I think so, and he has been in power for so long, control virtually most of the institutions of Cameroon. There are two candidates from the English-speaking. Why didn't you all go into a coalition to go against President Paul Biya? Because one would think that it would be too difficult to dislodge this man who has been in power for so many years.
So your suggestion is that we should not stand the election and just let it be. When you organize a coalition, it's organized before your candidate. It's not organized after. So I think your point is a point that is valid. If Mr. Biya was a young and dynamic and performant president who is sure to have a majority following in the country, so that you need to put people together to try to beat that majority. But Mr. Biya has been in place for 36 years, hasn't done anything in 36 years. And so he's not necessarily in a position whereby he commands a good portion of the electorate. From going around and the way people react and what has been happening during this campaign, it's more likely he might not be the 2-3 first if the will of the Cameroonian voter is respected at the polls.
We do appreciate very much again for taking this time to talk with us. And Christopher, let me say good luck on Sunday.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Joshua Osei is the presidential candidate of Cameroon's main opposition Social Democratic Front Party. He was speaking with me from Bamenda. Former Kenyan Prime Minister and leader of the opposition Orange Democratic Movement Party, Raila Odinga, says he wants a referendum to change the country's 2010 constitution. Speaking yesterday, Thursday, in Mingori County, Odinga said changing the constitution is inevitable. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, there's opposition to Odinga's proposal to amend the constitution.
Speaking at a campaign rally in Migori County, former Prime Minister Odinga dismissed criticism from his opponents, arguing that there are provisions of the constitution that should be amended for the benefit of Kenyan people. He said Kenyans are suffering because of the bloated economy brought about by a huge number of elected representatives in the government.
We have a new constitution, but that new constitution, like many other new constitutions all over the world, requires to be looked at after 80 years of experimentation so that we can preserve what is working and correct what is not working. We need to look at, for example, devolution. Does it need to be corrected? We look at the executive. Is the executive bloated for an economy such as the of Kenya?
Mr. Odinga said his handshake with President Uhuru Kenyatta is meant to address long-term issues that have affected decades of Kenya's socioeconomic development. He said other issues to be looked at include environmental conservation.
The issues of environmental conservation and preservation. There are several other issues that will need to be looked at. And that's the reason why I have said that if the Kenyan people feel there is something that needs to be corrected in our new constitution, then the people will decide.
The former Prime Minister's sentiments have since been criticized by his opponents who blame him of political sabotage. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto is among those who are opposed to the proposed constitutional changes, accusing Odinga of interference with the leadership of the government.
It can't be that all the time you lose an election, you say we must change our constitution. We want a referendum only if it will benefit Kenyans. We don't want to hear of referendum of those people who are interested in changing the constitution so as.
The call for a referendum to reduce the number of elected representatives in Kenya has divided political leaders in the country, with members of parliament allied to President Uhuru Kenyatta backing the proposed made by Deputy President William Ruto. However, Mr. Odinga insists the constitution must be changed, saying that anyone feeling uncomfortable with the proposal should quit.
There is something that needs to be corrected in our new constitution. Then the people will decide. And nobody can stop an idea whose time has come. The time to relook at our constitution is now. And therefore, if you don't want it, stay aside.
Mr. Odinga made his proposal to amend the constitution at a campaign rally for Orange Democratic Movement Party senatorial candidate Ochilo Ayacko in Migori County. The nomination of Mr. Ayacko prompted Migori Governor Okoth Obado to revolt and back the Federal Party of Kenya candidate Eddie Okech. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 5th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. The Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, says it welcomes President Cyril Ramaphosa's plan to reduce the country's high unemployment rate. Announcing the plan on Thursday, President Ramaphosa said his administration will create 275,000 more jobs a year. He says unemployment is the greatest challenge facing South Africa. Biki Mshalumshala is General Secretary of COSATU. He says the plan announced by President Ramaphosa was agreed upon by both the government, trade unions, and civil society.
I think the first thing we need just to explain is that what President Ramaphosa announced was the work of the all social partners, meaning Labour, government, community and businesses has been working for the last 3 months to conclude what was pronounced by President Cyril Ramaphosa. In other words, this is our work. In other words, we support because that has been the conclusion of our discussions.
Let's break it down then. The president said this will create 275,000 more jobs per year. Where would these jobs be? In the mining industry or in the service industry? Where?
In the plan, there are a number of initiatives that have been agreed of. For example, this plan on the phase one, as we call it, has been talking about the local procurement, the localization, and the reprioritization in the government budget. So in that process, there's been identification that you may have many jobs just by agreeing to reprioritize. You may have jobs in the public sector in terms of filling the critical vacancies, vacancies that have been budgeted for. If you go to some sectors in the private sector, so if you agree to procure local, there's been a quantification that if you, for example, you buy furniture inside the country, will be creating a number of jobs. So those figures are a combination of a number of areas that if you reprioritize and you dilute localization and local procurement, will create a number of jobs without putting new monies in the market.
The local procurement, which I think the president also mentioned, is what? Buying black-owned or supporting black-owned businesses?
No, it's about supporting South African companies. In other words, before you go outside and procure, you need to make the comparison and buy issues that are produced in South Africa. If everything is equal, then you buy the South African produced goods.
Biki Unshala Inshallah is the General Secretary of the Congress for South African Trade Unions. You are speaking with me from Johannesburg. The Power Africa initiative has sparked a dramatic change in the number of homes with electricity in Africa. The coordinator says the program is on track to reach its goal of 16 million connections by 2030. As Mariama Diallo reports from Washington, U.S. companies are taking part with some star power backing them up.
It's sobering news from the World Bank. Households in sub-Saharan Africa have the lowest rate of working electricity in the world. Former U.S. President Barack Obama vowed to change that and launched the Power Africa initiative 5 years ago.
We're going to start by investing $7 billion in U.S. government resources.
Fast forward to today, Power Africa coordinator Andrew Hertzkowitz says they've made a lot of progress.
We've helped 9,500 megawatts of deals reach financial close. Over 50 million people have access to electricity for the first time.
Speaking at Washington's Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, Hertzkowitz says Power Africa is on track to establish a total of 16 million electrical connections in homes and businesses by 2030. The initiative has more than 100 partners, including a number of U.S. companies that will make a lot of money helping to power up Africa.
There are companies like Rickley Hydro in Ohio that are selling parts and components for small mini hydro projects. You've got companies that are selling all kinds of parts and components that are being exported to Africa.
Johannes Erpelanian, director of the Initiative for Sustainable Energy Policy at Johns Hopkins, invited Hertzkowitz to speak at the school. He says Africa has a ways to catch up to the rest of the world.
So if you look at, for example, India, the electrification rate is now approaching 90% and it keeps climbing. But if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, we see a different pattern.
He believes progress in Africa isn't happening fast enough, something U.S. entrepreneur Thomas Maibatat, who has a solar energy business in his home country of Eritrea, is working to change.
We start with small solar, you know, small lights for families, and then they grow out of it, and now they want big ones. So Africa is going to lighten up. That we know. The thing is, how do you go about it in the best and the smartest way?
But Hertzkowitz says red tape, politics, and fickle governments have at times hampered the Power Africa initiative.
The biggest challenge is when a government changes the rules of the game. So a company's been negotiating for a few years for a deal, and then suddenly, you know, a government hears about something else and wants something different and then wants to renegotiate.
He says that discourages potential investors. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The UN Refugee Agency says populist politics and fear-mongering about immigration are eroding international protection for refugees fleeing conflict and persecution. The UNHCR Protection Chief spoke about growing protection concerns at the agency's annual refugee conference. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Conflict, persecution, and violence have displaced a record 68.5 million people around the world. Most are internally displaced, while 25 million are refugees. These are people who have crossed international borders and are entitled to international protection under the 1951 Refugee Convention. But UN Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Volker Türk, says this right is slipping away. He says some governments are taking political and legal measures to narrow the concept of who is a refugee. He says being able to flee and be recognized as a refugee can be a matter of life and death. Unfortunately, he notes, the issue of security is too often used to adopt restrictive approaches to deny refugees protection.
Of course, there's no doubt governments need and must ensure the security of their citizens. But this is entirely complementary with providing refuge to people who flee persecution.
Türk says refugees are the victims, not the perpetrators of violence and terror. He says they often have rejected extremism and been targeted, forcing them to flee for their lives. He says it is unjust to deny security to people who need it most.
I think both in the global north and in the global south, I have to say, it's our observation, that the dehumanization of refugees, of migrants, of IDPs, of stateless individuals has become a worrying trend. It results from inappropriate language, misinformation, deterrence, arbitrary detention, separation of families and children, and warehousing.
Türk says xenophobia, racism, and bigotry often are driven by fear, anger, and anxiety within communities. He says they must be confronted and addressed. He warns history shows how the mistreatment of the foreigner paves the way for the mistreatment of the citizen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Ghana, normally forest trees are owned by the government, but the Forestry Commission is now allowing cocoa farmers to register trees on their farms. This prevents loggers from cutting down the trees for timber, which will help decrease deforestation. Ed Afari, acting country director for the World Cocoa Foundation's Ghana office, talks to Ricky Stryak about the benefits of this new government action.
So we are very happy that World Cocoa Foundation and the consortium of others, including Sustainable Food Lab, Agroeco Louis Bork Institute, and Meridia work with the Government Forestry Commission to allow this to happen. And we have about 150 farmers in the Western region that we have tested this with. And now they have certificates that show that they can register trees and the trees on their farm, they own it and nobody can have access to it except them.
And what kind of impact do you hope it has on deforestation? I know especially cocoa farming, sometimes it has an impact on the forest canopy in a place. So do you hope this also decreases deforestation?
Definitely, yes. We know that when loggers have easy access and unfettered access to forest trees, they go everywhere to just make sure that they cut it down and use it for timber products. Now, with this law and farmers having access to the opportunity to register their trees and own it, loggers will not have the chance, so the trees can grow to the level that the farmers will want it to be. And if we have a lot of farmers having registered their trees, then we are sure that they will not be cut down. Farmers can also put in their business plans and be able to, you know, get access to funds used as collateral and be able to really get additional income. And we believe that, you know, with climate change now threatening cocoa farms, forest and shade trees can positively affect local climatic conditions by promoting cooler temperatures.
What are some of the obstacles in your way when you consider scaling up this model in order to cover the rest of Ghana?
I think the first obstacle is really about education, being aware of the law and the provision that allows farmers to register their trees. Now, our biggest challenge is with the timber industry and loggers who sometimes are able to pay money and have access to concessions. So that battle has to be handled well because, you know, farmers are the weakest link around, and sometimes they get bullied by these big men who have concessions all over Ghana in forest belts. We believe that with this law, the local assemblies, if they are well trained and educated, will be able to support the cocoa farmers to hold on because of the certificate that they have.
That was Ed Afari, Acting Country Director for the World Cocoa Foundation's Ghana office. He was speaking to Ricky Strayake from Accra. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the Confederation of African Football, where the continent's highest soccer ruling body has decided for the first time to introduce the video assistant referee, VAR, during the finals of this season's CAF Interclubs competition, the Toto CAF Champions League 2018 and Toto CAF Confederations Cup 2018. These follows the approval of the CAF Executive Committee at its meeting of the 27th to the 28th of September 2018 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The decision comes after the success of the premier implementation of the latest refereeing technology during the Total CAF Super Cup last February between Wydad Athletic Club of Morocco and TP Mazembe of DR Congo in Casablanca. Staying with CAF matters, Cameroon will host the 2019 African Cup of Nations under the auspices of the Confederation of African Football, CAF. This reassuring message was part of a high-level discussion between the President of the Republic of Cameroon, Paul Biya, and the President of the Confederation of African Football, Ahmed Ahmed, at the Unity Palace in Cameroon. Speaking to the press shortly after meeting with the President of Cameroon, CAF President Ahmed Ahmed debunked rumors that CAF will withdraw the hosting rights from Cameroon. He said CAF has never envisaged such a scenario, that normally it is a country that has the final say. Mr. Ahmed explained that the continental body was satisfied with the government's outright willingness to develop football infrastructure before the start of the competition.
C'est le Cameroun qui pourra nous dire demain, on est prêt.
In baseball news, the South African Under-23 baseball team will be competing in the Under-23 Baseball World Cup in Colombia from the 29th till the 28th of October. They will go into the tournament as huge underdogs against the best teams in the world, many of whom's players are professionals, but the experience will stand South Africa baseball in good stead for the future. Each player had to fork out as much as $3,000 for the tournament, with lots of fundraising efforts and some having to take out bank loans. Hayden Marty and Joshua Halverson are both Under-23 baseball players.
It's a great opportunity. It's an opportunity of a lifetime to go showcase your talent against the world's best, to play against the world's best. It's good for our country, you know, come back and teach the younger guys, be good role models to them, and teach what we learned up there.
Well, look, at the end of the day, all these guys are either professional or semi-professional, where we are obviously not. But at the end of the day, that gives us the go-ahead plan, because we are considered the underdogs, which means they're not going to see what's coming on our side, which I'm actually pretty excited about.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello. It's the weekend. You deserve something special. And I've got just the thing. Pan-African music with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa.
Yeah, more fire.
You'll hear exclusive interviews with Andy Jamea from Cameroon and Mamadou Kelly and his Desert Blues Band. Join me in my studio all the way from Timbuktu. Song of the Week features a hit song currently burning through Uganda. And there's so much more awesome music, you just don't want to miss it. So, Sweeten Up with me on Music Time in Africa this Sunday at 15 and 20:05 UTC.